Hi, everybody, and welcome to D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. From our microphones in downtown Washington, D.C., we have three guests with us today. We have Brian Young. Brian is the program manager of the Violence Reduction Program, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about. Individuals on community supervision, on parole and probation, what are we doing and what are other agencies doing regarding violence reduction? We have many individuals with a background of violence on our caseload, as all parole and probation agencies do, and that's one of the reasons why we're examining the violence reduction program today. Along with Brian, we have Michelle Hare Diggs, and Michelle Hare Diggs is a treatment specialist for the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, and Lisa Seiler, she is the community supervision officer for, again, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, and always the commercial before we get going, ladies and gentlemen. We're up to 130,000 requests on a monthly basis. We really appreciate all of your letters, all of your emails, and even a couple phone calls in terms of how well we're doing, suggesting new shows, and asking us to consider new topics, and sometimes some gentle criticism. So we really appreciate all of your comments, and you can get in touch with me directly at my email, Leonard, leonard.sipes at csosa.gov, or follow me on Twitter, which is twitter.com/Len, L-E-N, Sipes, S-I-P-E-S. And to Brian and to Michelle and to Lisa, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Thanks.
Brian Young, you're the program manager for the Violence Reduction Program. First of all, explain to me, what is the Violence Reduction Program?
The Violence Reduction Program is a three-phase program that we've put in place for young men 18 to 35 who has to have a history of violent weapon or drug charges. And basically what we're trying to do with those guys is bring them into a program and work with them to develop skills to reduce the likelihood that they'll continue to engage in aggressive acts or even violent acts when they're in the community. So how we do that is basically we look at people who are eligible. We get an assessment and pretreatment process. We follow that with a 12-week, 24-session cognitive behavioral therapy.
And cognitive behavioral therapy means what, Brian?
Well, you're working on a way a person thinks, and you're working on behavior that's related to their thinking patterns. But the fundamental thing that we're trying to achieve through the program is we're trying to do two things. We're trying to put programming in place based on research that about what works in community corrections. Mm-hmm. And there is strong research that suggests that cognitive behavioral programs tend to be more effective in working with offenders to change behaviors that are related to ongoing criminality. And then in the anger management realm, or the violence reduction realm where we're focused here, again, the cognitive behavioral programs are the programs that tend to perform best. And what we're trying to do through those sessions are role play, psychoeducational lessons, other techniques to help guys learn and understand what anger is, help them recognize how it creates problems in their life, help them change their thinking patterns around certain instances, provocations, situations, so that they can develop new skills, so that as they experience anxiety or depression or a sense of humiliation or guilt or anything that triggers anger, which may in turn trigger violence, we want them to have the skills to change their behavior so that when they are confronted with those issues the next time around, they respond differently.
Virtually every program that we have, whether it be domestic violence, whether it be substance abuse, whether it be the mental health treatment, we teach individuals how to deal with life circumstances without reacting or overreacting to those circumstances. And that's the heart and soul of the cognitive behavioral therapy approach, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so it's cognitive behavioral therapy teaching people a new way of thinking through situations, a new way of reacting to situations, and that is truly evidence-based. There is a ton of research that basically says that's the way to go, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and who comes into these programs? People hear violent criminals and or violent offenders on community supervision, and people say, well, what are they doing under community supervision? If they're violent, why aren't they in prison?
Well, they're not in prison. Some of the men have been in prison, and they're returning to prison with parole supervision following, or what we call supervised release in the District of Columbia. Some of the guys may have committed their current charge, may not have been serious enough to warrant a prison charge this time, but they may have violences in their background. So we want to get both of those kind of people into the group.
Right. But the point is that we don't choose community supervision, right?
That's up to the
judge. I mean, they come out of the prison system where the courts put them on probation, and they have histories of violence. Then isn't it in society's best interest to try to deal with a problem that they've probably had for quite some time in terms of overreacting to provocations?
Absolutely. And if we don't, we're not doing the best that we can based on what we know is out there, based on research and literature and these problems to promote public safety.
Right. Okay, we're going to go
irresponsible for us.
Yeah, I mean, if we ignored it, and I'm going to suggest that in most cases, most parole and probation agencies, all they would do throughout the country, most parole and probation agencies would simply refer them to the local health clinic, to whatever program that would be available there. There's not a lot of violence reduction initiatives going on, to my knowledge, anywhere throughout the country.
True.
Yeah. And so that's what makes us unique in this capacity. Okay, so but we're not going to suggest that we have all of the resources to deal with everybody who has a history of violence. We have a pretty concrete, very specific research-based program. But, you know, we're only probably, like we say in terms of mental health, like we say in terms of substance abuse, like we say in terms of other programs, we have programs to deal with domestic violence. We have programs to deal with a wide variety of issues, but rarely do they hit everybody in a comprehensive way, correct?
That's correct.
You know, we're talking about hitting some, but certainly not all, and probably not close to being all.
Right. And so the trick is, and what we try to do as an agency, recognizing that you can't touch everybody, we try to look at the level of risk that each individual presents to public safety. The people that present the most risk are the people we target first and get into these programs.
Right. And that's exactly what the research says. Research says you don't have to go after everybody. You've got to focus on the people who pose the most significant risk.
Absolutely.
Okay. We're going to go over to Michelle Hare Diggs, and Michelle is a treatment specialist. She is, again, with my agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. Michelle, one of the things that always interests me in terms of dealing with offenders, and I have a history. I've done counseling in the Maryland prison system. I've done Job Corps, where the kids had criminal histories. I've done gang counseling on the streets of Baltimore City. So I have some sense of what it's like in the real world to deal with offenders and people who have behavioral problems. And I've always used this phrase that many of them have attitudes, chips on their shoulders the size of Montana. Am I right or wrong?
Well, they initially come in with attitudes just because they don't want to be in a group setting. It makes a lot of them nervous to be in a group setting.
Would make me nervous to be in a group setting.
Me too.
Yeah. So, I mean, but that's something they got to get over.
Right. And okay. They do.
And so tell me a little bit about the treatment process.
Well, the first phase really helps them with that fear of the group setting. The first phase is treatment readiness. It gets them comfortable with me. It gets them comfortable with each other. It just makes them familiar with each other. So by the time we get to phase two, which is the meat of it, the calm group itself, controlling anger and learning to manage it. At that phase, they're comfortable with each other and myself, and they're able to share and get the most out of the program.
Brian and I talked about this whole concept of thinking for a change, some people call this in other states, the idea of teaching an individual how to deal with provocations, how to deal with circumstances, day-to-day circumstances. We're not talking about necessarily somebody coming after them with a knife. We're talking about day-to-day interactions with other human beings where they don't overreact to those set of circumstances. It is extraordinarily difficult to take a person who has responded in a particular way throughout the course of their lives and suddenly teach that person not to respond that way, correct?
It is. You're right. It's very difficult, but it is showing them a totally different way. That's what the whole group is. It shows them different ways of thinking. It helps them identify how, right now we're working on cognitive distortions. It's helping them realize that the way that they have been thinking has got them into the situations that they are in.
One of the things that I've done in my past life is I sat with the commissioner of one of the correctional divisions in the state of Maryland. We were about to do a series of statewide crime summits. And that particular commissioner and I sat with probably 100 individuals who were juveniles who were being adjudicated for homicide. at the Baltimore City Jail. And we said, we're not going to use your names. And it took us about a half an hour to warm up and to gain their trust. But in essence, this is what the kids said to me about violence. My words, not theirs. Mr. Sipes, you have to understand, violence is good. Violence keeps me safe. It keeps my property safe. It keeps my baby safe. It keeps my mother safe. It keeps my mother's home safe. Violence is a very natural reaction to the environment that I grew up in, and you don't understand. It's something I have to do. To one kid who basically murdered somebody else for a provocation, he stepped, accidentally or not, stepped on his foot while sitting on a stoop in Baltimore steps and in front of his girlfriend. And he basically said, I said, you're going to be, if you're convicted, you're going to be in prison probably for the rest of your life. Wouldn't you rethink that situation if you had to do it over again? He said to me, again, my words, not his, Mr. Sipes, you just don't understand. I had to do what I had to do. I didn't have any choice in the matter. Now, when you come at it with that sort of mindset, that's an extraordinarily difficult place for you to be.
It is.
First of all, am I right?
You are right. And it is a natural, anger is a natural emotion for so many different people, so many different individuals. So we just try to get them to weigh the cost of, and that's the whole purpose of this program, to weigh the cost and the benefits of what their anger can cause them.
And they can do that. I mean, that's one of the points that the public needs to hear, that it is possible to reorient a person's thinking in terms of how they handle day-to-day provocations.
You're correct.
You know, but that's the meat of the situation, I think. How do you get them to understand that? How do you get them to come to that conclusion?
We do it with role play exercises. They have homework assignments. We do a lot of cost-benefit analysis where we take different examples and we have them weigh what would be the cost of this, what would be the benefit of this, and which situation would you choose? We had a gentleman just last week. He was rearrested. He was stopped by the police for a crime that he did not commit. And he was able to maintain himself in order for the person who was ever robbed, for her to come. He had to wait for her to come to the scene and identify that he was not the person. Mm-hmm. But if this were any other situation, he admitted that he would have lost his cool and it would have made the situation worse. But he was able to maintain himself. He didn't get upset. And he was just able to keep his cool.
And one of the things that Brian and I were talking about before the program is that there are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples that members of the group have brought to us that basically substantiate what you've just told us, that they you know, they're in with their baby's mother and she's yelling at him because he's not doing what he needs to do, and he doesn't get upset, he doesn't yell, he doesn't scream, he doesn't raise his fist. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, depending upon your point of view, that was a big change for that person.
It is. And they also learn relaxation techniques, which really helps in a lot of their home settings. They learn how to mentally take themselves away from things that might cause them to be angry. Mm-hmm. And we teach this not just in your home setting. We teach them to do this at work. We teach them to do that in the probation office, whatever the case is, just to help them maintain themselves.
Do they really understand the concept? When I was with Job Corps was an amazing arrangement where they would take care of your medical care, your food. They would train you, get your GED, relocate you into another city, help you with an apartment, buy you your tools if you took the... And so it was a pretty good comprehensive program for kids who were unfortunately in a jam. And many of them willingly crossed the bridge from law violation to law-abiding behavior, from tax burdens to taxpayers. They made that conscious choice. A lot of them didn't. Because they didn't know how you could give a person a GED, you can give them a plumbing certificate, but that doesn't necessarily mean he or she knows how to cross that bridge. When they're done this treatment process, do they really know how to cross that bridge from violent to nonviolent behavior?
Well, we just encourage them. It takes practice. It doesn't happen over time. We also have phase three of the program, which they're matched up with community coaches that help them along the way, that help them. So they're not just left to fend from themselves. They have like a mentor. That's what they are. They're life coaches who have been through the same situations and who are able to coach them and give them helpful advice. And they meet with these coaches once a week.
That's great. Okay, we're going to go over to Lisa. And one of the reasons why we've invited Lisa into the program is that she is a community supervision officer. Most people would know them as parole and probation agents throughout the country. And Lisa, I screwed up your last name, didn't I, when I made the introductions. It's Lisa Seiler. Yes. Seiler. Okay. I apologize for that. And Lisa, now you've been in, and you probably want to rearrange that microphone just a little bit. Thank you. You've been in this program for how long?
I believe the cases were assigned to me in January. So this is my first phase of the program, first time I've been involved with the violence reduction program.
The community supervision officers are basically the heart and soul of the court services and offender supervision agency. Now, we have a dual role. We have an enforcement role, and we will not hesitate to put somebody back in prison.
If need be.
But at the same time, we have a treatment role. The research is abundantly clear that if we provide services to individuals, they do a lot better than if we don't provide services. So we try to provide mental health assistance, domestic violence assistance. We try to provide drug treatment or refer the person to drug treatment resources. We have our own group called VOTE, who helps them in terms of their educational and vocational needs. We try to get them in the programs. We advocate for them. We work with them. And the violence reduction program seems to be just along the lines of any other program that we do. It's a service. It's a treatment program. But at the same time, you play that dual role, and you walk a very tough tightrope between enforcing public safety and helping the individual.
Yes, a lot of what my role is, initially my role was really just to encourage the guys to attend groups and to, you know, try to give it a chance. Because, you know, in the beginning you're kind of thrown in together, you're given a new CSO, and they're really explained. I have to really break it down for them and make it, I have to kind of become a salesman. I'm like that used car salesman that really has to get them to buy into the program and get them to report as they're supposed to for their groups. But once they get in, they don't need me to be the one that's like, keep going. They really want to come because they're getting so much out of the group. After they go through the first phase, they really do form a bond together.
Mm-hmm.
And they rely on each other for input and information. And, you know, when one goes, you know, isn't there, they're wondering where was he today? You know, there was one guy that had to go back to court for another issue, and they were all wondering what happened at court. So they asked me, do you know what happened? So they really become close. They become their own support system.
And isn't that the key? Because I'm not quite sure they're going to listen to us.
It is. Part of it is also...
Not to say that we're not there to provide treatment. We are.
Yes.
But, I mean, their peer group is the most important influencer.
Definitely.
Provides the most influence. The peer group plus the family plus friends, they're the groups that really motivate them to either change or continue in a criminal lifestyle.
Exactly. And they get a lot of support within the group. If somebody's not understanding, you know, what it is that they're talking about, they're not really grasping the information, a lot of the guys will step in and kind of give them their own example, and they start to share and try to break it down in a way that everyone's going to understand it, you know, if there's one particular guy that doesn't understand it. And with that, I get a lot of information from Michelle from the treatment side from groups. I get a lot of information as to how I can implement. I find out what she's working on in the group, and I can use that in my supervision strategies to kind of reinforce what they're talking about when they come to me with their supervision needs.
I'm going to reintroduce the program and reintroduce the participants, because we're going to go back to Brian Young. Brian Young is the program manager of the Violence Reduction Program here at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. We have Michelle Hare Diggs as the treatment specialist, and Lisa Seiler. She is a community supervision officer. Okay, Brian, you've heard from Michelle. You've heard from Lisa. Anything to add or subtract?
Nothing to add or subtract other than to say, these two working together really demonstrate and exemplify what we're trying to do here. The whole process of working with somebody is to identify their risk, and we want to target the highest risk people first, but we also have to identify their needs. And that issue of criminal peers is, you know, it's one of the big six criminogenic needs. It's one of the big six needs related to criminal recidivism that we look at. And the program is designed to help everybody make good decisions around what their peer group is. their attitudes towards authority and towards, you know, normal things like getting up and going to a job and those sorts of things. So the collaboration here and both people becoming a change agent is really exemplified by what Michelle and Lisa talked about.
Mm-hmm. It is difficult in the minds of so many people. And again, we're not afraid, nor do we hesitate for public safety reasons to put an individual back in prison. But if we can take an individual who has always responded violently now, and Lisa, you're suggesting that I'm saying something wrong. Go ahead.
No, I'm suggesting completely the opposite. I completely agree. I think we have a responsibility to the community to identify those individuals who just really aren't putting forth the effort to change and aren't putting forth, you know, they're really not taking advantage of the services and they're just continuing on the path. And when the need comes, we will address that and go to the, you know, have them put back in jail, as you said. However, I also think that we have a responsibility to help people get out of their own way. And this group really helps people understand that what their thinking translates into behavior. A lot of times these guys don't really understand that the thoughts that go in their head make them behave in a certain way. They think that there's just a natural reaction.
And I totally agree with that. Totally agree with that. And I totally agree with it in terms of substance abuse. I totally agree with it in terms of mental health. I totally agree with it in terms of education. Totally agree with it in terms of getting jobs. There's nothing I disagree with. The research is abundantly clear. The more you help them, the better they're going to do, the less they're going to recidivate, the fewer prisons we're going to have to build, the less taxpayers are going to have to pay out for their behalf. The flip side of that is something else we have to deal with, is that I get a newspaper summary every day or a variety of newspaper summaries every day. And in essence, what the newspaper summaries say on a daily basis is violent person does something violent again. Now, if the public gets a steady stream on the radio and television and in the newspapers of violent person does something again, they're going to sit here and listen to this program and say, ah, a bunch of bureaucrats from downtown D.C., don't you understand that, you know, we've got to target these individuals. And in some cases, we do, because they show propensities towards violence that they are a risk to public safety. Again, we'll target them and we won't hesitate to work with the courts and the parole commission to return them to prison. But what you're saying is that we got to do a better job of providing services, which is exactly what the research has to say.
I really think that with the information that we could get from the program, the way that it's applied to the offenders, they're not just going in and having groups. They're also having psychological testing. We're also finding out what their functioning is. All of this comes together so we get a better picture of the individual and of the need base. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're going to try to talk to a person who doesn't have the vocabulary and doesn't have the ability to process vocabulary, that's another issue. So if we can identify that, mm-hmm. we can use that and figure out this person, maybe not words is not the way that they communicate as effectively. Mm-hmm. They're more of a hands-on learner. Mm-hmm. Then we can start to make them do steps. You know, I always say baby steps. We're going to do one thing at a time. And by that, we're able to change behavior. You have to really find and identify what it is with each person that the issue is within the group. That's the way that the group is set up. We're able to not only in a group setting but also individually identify this person has this issue. You know, this seems to be an issue with this person. And with that, we're able to work together through the treatment specialist and with the supervision side. We're able to work together to help this person move, kind of get out of their own way and understand that their thoughts are what get in their own way. And if they can stop their thoughts or change their thinking, then their behavior changes. And we get examples of it all the time and how the behavior is changing.
And I think that's the most powerful thing because, you know, again, I've been in this business for a while, and it's always very gratifying when you take an individual who doesn't know how to deal with the world as it is.
That's the hugest part. You know, a lot of things we take for granted that, you know, we know how to ride the subway or we're even able to read a map to figure out how to get from point A to point B. And you have a 19-year-old kid that sits in front of you and says, I don't know how to ride the subway. I don't have the funds to get down here every day because I can't afford to pay for a cab. Wait a minute, you live, you know, so many blocks away, but you can't figure out how to ride the subway. For him, it was such an obstacle because he just was terrified to figure this out. So then it brought to my attention, okay, we have to go back to kind of a few more steps back than I thought we were. A lot of times people are afraid to tell you what their abilities and their deficiencies are. And once you...
So am I, by the way.
Yeah,
so are most people.
It is.
My wife chastised me severely last night because of a fight that we had a couple days ago when I just got around to telling her the reason for it. And she said, it took you 3 days to tell me then, huh?
Yeah.
You know, and I've got Michelle over here laughing. She's so everybody is going through the same experience. So the person is naturally reluctant to say, hey, I can't deal with the subway.
So a part of the group and a part of being able to interact with the offenders and the guys is really trying to pull this information out. What are the needs? You know, we have the assessment and we have the screener, and it really gives us a good indication. But from there, we need to probe further to find out, if this is an issue, how big of an issue is it? You know, if education is an issue, are we dealing with just the fact that he dropped out, or are we dealing with an even bigger issue of comprehension and having other learning disabilities?
When I ran a group in the Maryland prison system, I had two individuals squaring off at each other. And it was like, have we not discussed this, guys? Have we not discussed that there's a better way? I said, you're really going to assault the other person in prison in a treatment program. How many years do you think this is going to add on to your sentence? Do you really want to go that far? And I said, and they both backed off. And I said, okay, well, this is it. This is the heart and soul of this, mm-hmm. gentleman. I said, it's just not squaring off with each other while you're in a prison setting. It's also walking down the street and somebody has a perceived insult, or your friend and neighbor, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, your girlfriend,
day-to-day living without getting overly emotional about stuff that you shouldn't be getting overly emotional about.
I think a lot of it is too, is that, and Michelle can touch on this more, is identifying the emotion, because a lot of times they think it's anger, but it's really not.
Okay, then that's a lovely point that I want to get to, Michelle. In some of the other programs that we've talked about this kind of an offender, you know, you sit down with this guy and you know, he's got this hard attitude and he looks hard and he acts hard. And all that is, in many instances, and again, I'm going to get emails saying I'm making excuses for criminal behavior. I'm not. All that is insecurity. All that is, the harder that person appears, the weaker that person really is. That's a shell that person has learned to put on for his entire life. Am I right or wrong?
You're right. A lot of times they just don't even know how to identify the source of their anger. So in the group, we touch a lot on focusing on what are your emotions really. It might not even be anger. It could be jealousy. It could be depression. So we try to focus on identifying what is your real emotion, and is that what you're causing? Are the mask that you're putting on? Are you angry? What are you putting that mask on for? Mm-hmm. What is it to hide? Is it that you're really jealous of your brother, or is it that you're really sad that your father was never around?
Or the fact that you raised yourself from the age of 8?
Exactly.
Which to me is most, in most cases, of the offenders we're dealing with.
And actually, there's two gentlemen in my current group who they really have realized that they're just angry at their father. One of the fathers have passed away, and he's still angry, and he's able to identify that now. So he's working on writing a letter to his deceased father.
And a lot of males, but especially female offenders, are victims of sexual violence at a young age.
Yes.
By people who they know. So if that happens to you, how do you go through life without that chip on your shoulder the size of Montana? And that's not an unusual occurrence for males, but especially it's phenomenally large for females.
Yes, you're right.
So, I mean, that's just – isn't that the heart and soul of everything we're talking about here? And one of the reasons why the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, my agency, our agency, is trying to address this is that these individuals are never going to shake it. They may grow out of it. Because recidivism decreases dramatically at age 40 and above. But between 0 and 40, how many times is he going to go to prison and how many people is he going to hurt until he learns not to do it and to think about it in a different way, to think about how he or she interacts with people on a day-to-day basis?
Well, we like to think that the coping skills that they're gaining from the group will help them get through this.
But that's it. How do you interact with, how do you deal with life as it is without clenching a fist? How do you deal with life as it is without jumping in somebody's face?
You use your relaxation techniques. You use your peers. You have to. If you want to stay in society, that's what you have to do. If you don't want to go back to prison, you have to find different ways to manage and cope to get through this.
All right. We only have about 30 seconds left in an extraordinarily fascinating program. Brian, did you want to wrap up or do you want to let Michelle do it or Lisa or what do you want to say? Lisa, oh yeah, Michelle, let me go back to you again. In essence, I'm just going to remind the public one more time. It is possible for these individuals to change. The larger public doesn't believe that. But our experience is that it is possible for people who have lived histories, have had histories of violence, to interact with the world truly as it is without resorting to violence.
It is possible. And it may not happen overnight, but it takes practice and it can happen.
And that is the bottom line in terms of what it is that we're trying to do.
That's the bottom line.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. I've been your host, Leonard Sipes. At our microphones today is Brian Young, Program Manager for the Violence Reduction Program, Michelle Hare-Diggs, Treatment Specialist, again, for the Violence Reduction Program, and Lisa Seiler, who is finally got her name pronounced correctly, and she is a Community Supervision Officer. I want to thank everybody for all of your letters, all of your emails, your phone calls, for suggestions, criticisms, and comments about the show. Keep them coming in, and please have yourselves a very pleasant day.